is no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast
on the left.
Right from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
I got like an extra runny nose today. I think it's because we're covering a British topic. I think a lot of British people have that nasal drip where it goes all the way back because of the bad ducks.
No, that's not true. No, I don't think that's not a stereotype of the British people, a runny nose.
And they've got a lot of slime behind their Adam's apple. I don't know for sure. I'm not a doctor in England, so I'm not sure. But we'll find out. We go there for a UK tour in September. Can't wait.
Yeah. Can't wait to see you guys. The strange, like, stereotypes you come up with for groups of people.
Oh, Deirdre. Deirdre, is this my daughter or is this my wife? Oh, Deirdre.
All right.
Seems like a very serious day.
Yeah, seems like a vision problem there. Okay, this is the last podcast on the left. I am Ben. That's Marcus.
Hello.
We got Henry over in Los Angeles. How you doing, buddy?
I am 178 pounds horny today for this topic. I am so excited for this topic. This is serious.
This is really serious.
This is fucking serious.
Okay.
I already hear the mocking tone in your voice.
I'm not mocking. No, this is British. And as we talked about before the show, anything that happens in the UK with the British folks, I take very seriously because they're a serious people, let's be honest.
They sound very intelligent sometimes.
They really do. So today's topic, you know, I think we've been doing this podcast long enough to really handle this topic. I really do.
I do too.
It's the Roswell of the UK,
mm-hmm.
and it is called
very good.
Rendlesham.
I hate you, man.
The Rendlesham Forest UFO incident.
It's called Rendlesham.
Rendlesham sounds like a large man who works on a farm. If you just say Rendlesham, it sounds like a man you pay that he takes big boulders out of unusable dirt. Like, that's part of what he does. And the other thing is, sometimes, if you're real tired, he'll make love to your wife.
All right. He also kind of sounds like someone you say, Rendlesham, and then he's in the middle of taking a dump, and he says, whoop, and then the dump goes right back into his butt, and then he's like, puts on his trousers, like, I'm ready to work again.
No, actually, it's an incredibly compelling UFO case.
Yes, I know. Rendlesham. That's what we're covering today. A super, as Henry said, compelling UFO case. So this is, actually, I'm very excited.
Yeah, the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident is perhaps the most well-documented, credible, and impressive collection of UFO sightings in modern times.
Yeah, Marcus, yeah!
Uh-oh.
Over the course of two nights in December of 1980, dozens of U.S. military personnel stationed in Suffolk, England, witnessed intelligently controlled craft in the sky. And as if that wasn't enough, a further two soldiers claimed to have come into contact with the craft while it was actually on the ground.
Ooh, so fun!
Now, the reason why we say this is so credible is because of the people who have come forward in the intervening years to speak about the incident. First, let's acknowledge the author of Encounter at Rendlesham, our main source for this series.
This is definitely the most legit of the books about the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, because Nick Pope has spent a long time being very serious, and he wants to make sure that he gets enough of his information in there as possible, as tight as possible. But I will say, I think there are more Cuckoo Bananas self-published books about the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident than almost any other topic in UFO history, because there are many men in this that believe they are the main character.
Interesting. All right. Very cool. And of course, the Rendlesham, a lot of times, well, never mind. I was going to get a little blue with it.
Okay.
The Rendlesham.
What?
You don't want to go? Come on, get a little blue. Come
get
on.
A little blue with it. Turn the lights down.
Usually the
late nights, man.
Rendlesham
late
incident is when you have sex with a man in the woods. I don't know. I was going to get a little blue there, but.
You talk about the brambles from Central Park. You're saying that you could go out into the Rendlesham Forest, and that's where you get your dick sucked by a man with one eye. I see.
Okay.
Well, the author of Encounter at Rendlesham, as Henry said, is Nick Pope. From 1991 to 1994, Pope actually worked for the British Ministry of Defense investigating UFOs, alien abductions, crop circles, and all the other weird shit that nobody else wanted to deal with.
He took it as a point of pride that he was saddled with the secrets of the UK government, but little did he know, the rest of the government viewed him as a diaper boy. I do believe they gave him all of the shit that they didn't want to deal with, but Nick Pope, as we have all done many times in the past and will continue to do, you flip and reverse it. Being like, I'll take your poo-poo diaper. You call me diaper boy? Guess what? I'll sit on my shit for 12 hours. I'm great at it. I love it.
Absolutely. Like an angry female astronaut on the way to kill her ex-boyfriend.
Well, the other person involved in this story who has a large amount of credibility is U.S. Military Colonel Charles Halt. He was the deputy base commander of one of the two military bases involved in the Rendlesham Forest incident and has gone on record multiple times as being a skeptic turned believer.
Awesome. Those are the best when they're skeptical and then they come to believe.
Yep. J. Allen Hynek was like that. Stanton Friedman was like that. All of the people that are like the most down-to-earth, grounded, quote-unquote grounded UFO experts in the entire field, normally they came at the subject looking to debunk it.
Right,
and
right.
And now they found themselves with the overwhelming waves of evidence being like, oh, well, now I've actually, I am just a ufologist and my family has left me.
So there are a lot of military people involved here.
It's nothing but military people involved here.
Yes. Is this the, I mean, obviously that has to make it so, that's why it's so credible, I suppose.
Yes.
But does this case involve more military people than any other case that we've covered so far?
From what we've covered, yes, for definite. Besides, I'd say the Hudson Valley Triangle, which actually got a lot of attention, and when we talked about the Phoenix Lights briefly, that also got quite a bit of attention from the military. But this story is, that's the reason why, for me, this is one of the most interesting, compelling, because of the witnesses involved.
Right,
these
right.
people, for the most part, their jobs are to observe.
Right. Awesome. Cool.
Yeah. But the fact that it does involve almost exclusively military people is what also makes this so frustrating.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because Pope, Halt, and the other witnesses to this incident fully admit that they have more information than what they're legally allowed to share with the public, because a lot of the information surrounding the incident is still classified.
Oh.
And this is ultimately frustrating because they do know the answers to some of the questions that crop up when it comes to the story, but both the law and their own personal honor prevent them from sharing those missing pieces of the puzzle.
Also because, Marcus, bullets cheap. Remember that? We're going to cover that a lot in the second episode. Bullets are cheap, which should be the opposite. That's the old Chris Rock bit, is that you should make the bullets expensive.
Yeah, I've heard remember that. You know what I think they should do instead of making the bullets expensive? Make them the size of a gun.
Cool. and then you just throw them like a loaf of bread at people.
So some of the questions, what were some of the questions? Like, Mr. Military Man, do they have two penises? Do the aliens have two penises? Or
as a matter of fact, that is classified information. But let's just say they don't not have two penises. Wink, 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 wink. Which is also wonder why human beings are born with two nostrils.
Oh, sir, that is not a vagina, sir. Alien, I am a male species.
The vagina of a man is in the nose. Everybody wants sex up the butthole. But I'll tell you what, the real clit is behind the sinuses. Fuck me in the brain, I say.
So gross.
But before we get into the nights in question, it's important to know exactly how important the area around Rendlesham Forest in England was to both the U.S. military and to the NATO defense system at large.
Oh.
This, to me, is the biggest, like, the biggest ringing bell, the biggest swinging tits of this whole story. It's just how important these two twin bases were to the U.S. and the U.K. government, which is why, in the end, which we come to the second episode, the idea that any of this being a prank or any of this being taken very lightly, I think, is ludicrous, because this place was highly top secret.
Interesting. Now I cannot think about thinking about the Liberty Bell, but if it was just two swinging tits instead of a bell,
I think about.
Like, they cracked our swinging tits, and then what a world that would be.
Live from your grave. From your grave.
Now, before this area came to be a home for the U.S. Air Force during the Cold War, this area of Suffolk was home to the discovery of one of the most important military technologies of modern times, radar.
Oh.
Now, I didn't know this personally, but radar was actually discovered on accident. Their original aim with the project was to focus radio waves into a death ray that could shoot German planes out of the sky in the lead up to World War II.
That's fucking sweet.
That's
you imagine them just up there just being like, "Oof, what is happening? Fish my seat. Have I shied to my pants? Have I shied to my pants? Oh, why is my so warm? Oh, I put the seat warmers on. That must be it. Wait, no. It's a death ray. No.
Oh, no.
But what they found instead at Bodsey Manor was that those radio waves could be used to detect aircraft. And once that was discovered, the Brits gained a key advantage over the Jerrys when the Nazis came flying over the English Channel.
Mm.
Eventually, though, the radar technology was taken over by us Americans and evolved into a long-distance radar system codenamed Cobra Mist.
Yeah, dude. I remember that Axe flavor.
Cobra Mist?
Cobra Mist.
They got to get more artistically minded people in the military again. That
dude,
is
man, Cobra
awesome.
Mist rules.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You're just like walking through the floor. Can you imagine that? And you're like, oh, there's a fog rolling in and there's thousands of floating snakes.
Now, all this talk of radar may seem inconsequential at first glance, but when you take into account that many of the most credible UFO sightings in history have occurred around military bases or were witnessed by military personnel, it starts to make a bit more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Henry might have a bit of a different opinion here, but I think that if actual nuts and bolts UFOs are coming to visit the Earth from wherever, whether it be another planet or another dimension, then it would make the most sense for them to scope out our military.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have the opposite. I have the totally same opinion. I believe that, of course, because if they are nuts and bolts UFOs, because that's kind of what this episode is a little bit about, right? Especially episode one of this series, is if these are actual crafts that arrive from a different part of the solar system or another solar system or for another universe through a wormhole, why would they not show up and go straight to where our fucking planes are? They would show up to where the other things that buzz around, that do the kind of shit, because especially, what if, again, one weird alternative theory is that the ships themselves are aliens, that they're literally going to meet their friends on this planet. They literally show up to see the other top secret planets. I mean, this is a great Pixar movie.
Yeah, I was about to say, this is just Cars.
Maybe. But maybe it's real. If Cars was real, then that's that version of the story. That they show up. Because also, maybe they're looking to fuck.
Maybe. Because
some of these things are fucking hot. Our stealth bomber, that's kind of sexy, right? You can see, like, when people fuck objects here and because their wires are crisscrossed and for some reason their DNA doesn't want them to breed, so they fall in love with a bridge. What if it's the same thing like that, but the UFOs actually can try to breed with our planes? That I'm not just saying they're horny for our planes. That's just one idea I have. So, but then I have a more wooey woo idea that I'm going to save.
Okay, you have a more wooey wooey idea than that these UFOs are trying to have sex with our planes. Okay.
That's science. That's undiscovered science is what I'm talking about.
I see. I do think it would be cute to see a montage of the UFOs coming down and then like meeting up around like Epcot Center and then going on the rides, wearing little Mickey Mouse hats.
And then they're back over at the, like, let's say, like, the Port Orleans, and the one jet's back on, it's like, it's got its back on there, and the UFO pulls out its tube, right, with its fucking, and it sticks its tube into the you know, like, to fill her up.
Sure.
Pulls out the tube and shoots
the opening
blue.
Credits to Dr. Strangelove.
I don't know.
All right.
I'm just saying, what if it's real? What if it's real?
I don't know how we've gotten here, but I like it.
Well, the Rendlesham Forest area makes even more sense once you get to the Cold War. See, this area was home to not one, but two military bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge. And these two bases were separated by a few hundred yards of forest. Rendlesham Forest.
Ooh, cool.
And it was thick.
Yeah.
It was as thick as the bush hairs on a duke over there.
A duke? Like the Duke of York?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
They don't trim.
I was quite
confused.
You know
that they don't trim. They don't manscape.
No.
No, definitely not. It's a point of pride for them to keep that bush hair long and frustrated.
Frustrated bush hair.
I don't, Marcus, continue with the story. I can't keep on animating inanimate things. I was, again, thinking about bush hairs all tangled up and be like, so... How'd we get here?
How'd we get here?
Yeah. Well, Bentwaters and Woodbridge were both United States military bases, and the Brits have never been all that keen on our decades-long military presence in their country.
Yeah.
According to Nick Pope, the post-World War II British joke was that American soldiers were overpaid, oversexed, and over-here... Meaning England.
I know. Oh. It's just, honestly,
oh,
Mr.
Okay. I got mad. I just got mad for a second.
Yeah.
But you know what? The U.S. soldiers, they had a comeback.
What was that?
This is what they called the Brits. Quote,
underpaid, undersexed, and under Eisenhower.
Oh, God. Oh, to get hammered over in a saloon with those kind of funny guys. I wouldn't even know what military to choose. All the humor is so good. My gosh.
You're going to choose Air Force guys.
You got to.
Yeah.
They're very fun. Surprisingly hammered.
Yeah.
Drink a lot.
Who does drink the most?
For our military listeners out there, the Navy, the Army, or the Air Force, who drinks the most?
Oh, I would assume it's the Navy. Are we doing crowd work at a USO show?
Not yet. No, we haven't made that. We haven't made it yet.
But when it came to being stationed at Rendlesham Forest, Americans didn't necessarily enjoy that particular posting because it had a long-standing reputation for being creepy, sinister, and overall just kind of depressing.
The forest.
The whole area of England.
Interesting.
I believe the term was East Anglia was where they were at, which was this area of the United Kingdom, which is about 60 miles northeast of London on the beach. Now, when you hear this concept of like, man, we're stationed on the beach, that's got to be fucking killer. You know,
we're
crushing Natty Lights, we're out there surfing like it's Apocalypse Now and all the shit. But this was a British beach, which meant that the sand was gray, and I want to say it was filled with eels. It is a gross-ass, gray-as-fuck beach.
Aww.
That was purposefully put out into a remote area of the UK where they were not vacationing.
Okay, so these guys weren't having a great time out there.
No, they weren't. But the Woodbridge and Bentwaters bases were horribly important in a strategic sense when it came to the Cold War between America and Russia.
Mm.
And for those of you not well-versed in Cold War history, when it came to Europe, you had two coalitions. You had NATO, led by the United States, because we were the only country who weren't blown to hell in World War II.
Yeah!
Yeah, we did it.
We did.
We were further away than they were.
And you had the Warsaw Pact nations controlled by the Soviet Union. Now, if those Warsaw Pact countries like Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, or Poland decided to follow the orders of the Soviet Union and invade Western Europe by ground, they were going to need backup. And that is where Bentwaters and Woodbridge came in. Located on the eastern coast of England, both bases were fully stocked with American A-10 Warthogs, which could be called in to blow Soviet ground forces to hell from above, just like they later did in the Gulf War.
Warthog is a very nice name for a large military vehicle. Horrible name for a high school kid. Horrible name.
Unless, again, you own it and you're like on the offensive line for the football
team.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's what you got to do. Again, always flip it and reverse it. It was actually in an area called Suffolk.
I think it's pronounced Suffolk.
Yeah.
I also did think about the Polish. They're like, oh, it's going to be a ground war, and then them just driving their planes.
Well, the Polish also then released their army of evil toys, like an evil Jack in the Box and a really sharp slinky that come rolling through the, which as a visual is incredible.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
But, is easily destroyed by something the likes of a fire extinguisher.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm sure we have like a Polish side. scientist who listens to us and really doesn't like being mocked. So the Polish people are very smart, too.
Yes.
We can be.
Yeah,
we really can be. We're very able people. We're survivors.
Yeah, is what we are. Absolutely.
Like Beyonce.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I always think of Beyonce and then immediately the Polish.
Just put my butt next to Beyonce's and you see the true meaning of being Polish.
But the Bentwaters and Woodbridge bases may have been hiding something much more powerful than mere warthogs. See, it is the policy of the United Kingdom to neither confirm nor deny allegations as to where nuclear weapons were stored in country.
Mm.
And that was definitely the case when it came to the question of nuclear weapons at Rendlesham. But listen to this quote from Lord Peter Hill Norton, a former UK Chief of Defence Staff and Chair of the NATO Military Committee. This is what he wrote concerning the Rendlesham incident.
All right.
My position, both privately and publicly expressed over the last dozen years or more, is that there are only two possibilities. Either, A, an intrusion into our airspace and a landing by unidentified craft took place at Rendlesham as described, or B, the deputy commander of an operational nuclear-armed U.S. Air Force base in England and a large number of his enlisted men are either hallucinating or lying.
But basically what he is saying is this place was a little bit more important than anybody would like to let on because it might have held a cache of over 500 nuclear bombs that were going to be our first wave attack against the Soviets. So the idea that these people on this base,
right,
either one of these bases or a bunch of yahoos is highly slim to none.
So by this slip of the hand and from evidence we'll cover later, we can infer that there most likely were indeed large amounts of nuclear weapons at either Woodbridge, Bentwaters, or both.
Cool.
And that brings us to another point about the locations of UFO sightings and why they appear in the places that they do. Now, some people posit that it is not a coincidence that the UFO sighting explosion coincided with the splitting of the atom.
Huh.
The hypothesis is that when humanity discovered nuclear energy, we entered a higher echelon of scientific knowledge and therefore merited more attention. Just like humans would pay more attention to monkeys if they suddenly learned how to drive.
Monkey Uber? I
love that.
I think we've actually talked about Monkey Uber before. I swear to God, we have.
I'm pretty certain we have.
Yes.
It's true. Yeah, if you showed up and the Uber driver's just a monkey in there, and he's like points to the back of the car, you know, I'd be like, I don't even go anywhere. Just cruise, buddy.
Just ride.
We're just
going to
put on the radio. I'm going to sit in the front seat. I'm going to share me and him are going to hit a vape together and just have a fun afternoon.
But absolutely.
That's been the ongoing theory. His reason why UFO sightings have shot up since the 1940s is that when we split the atom,
right,
they now realize that we can start to manipulate our environment on a quantum level, that's kind of the first steps towards essentially cosmic travel, towards true understanding of the nature of reality, all yada, yada, yada. And also, they know for a fact that we're a bunch of really angry, territory-obsessed monkeys, and that we will probably destroy ourselves before achieving anything the likes that they have achieved.
Right.
This is all, again, this is fully nuts and bolts UFO shit, which I'm not fully sold on, but I also, this is the idea.
Yeah.
That if them showing up as our intergalactic babysitters.
And maybe a correlation between all the video footage, right, and the advancement of technology and stuff like that also, maybe, perhaps?
Possibly, but the biggest sighting, like the largest swaths of sightings happened before video technology really became as ubiquitous as it is now.
Cool.
And you say how convenient, but partially it's also maybe because of that fact.
Yeah.
They do not want to be videotaped.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, the skeptics say that when we split the atom, it just opened our imagination to new and more terrifying possibilities, and that combined with Cold War paranoia produced the large number of sightings seen in the 50s onward, essentially saying that our imaginations just kind of ran away from us.
Sure. And that feeds into my psychic principle, which is the idea that we helped create them, because it did expand our imagination. It's supposed to expand our imagination, and that's what it did, and that's actually going to help us in the long run.
Yeah, and granted, most UFO sightings are definitely either misidentifications or outright lies.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't explain why UFOs are drawn to places either housing nuclear weapons or places powered by nuclear energy. Nor does it explain why these sightings are so goddamn dramatic.
This is another reason that we should invest in nuclear energy in order to avoid foreign wars and protect our environment. We could have UFOs overhead constantly, and that would be so fun.
Yeah, man. We just put a couple of naked girls out there, a couple of naked dudes, see what they choose, man. Just out there just like dancing around the nuclear bombs, UFOs dancing back and forth. You got some fucking DJ Jazzy Jeff going, man.
That's just the middle. That's just the end of the first act of Independence Day.
Yes. I want that. What if it's real? What if that was real?
It was a unique idea, Marcus.
Now, we've covered one of these nuclear buzzes briefly in the past. During the Hudson Valley UFO incident in 1984, a gigantic diamond-shaped UFO swooped the Indian Point nuclear power plant near Peekskill, New York, for about 15 minutes, hovering above the exhaust funnel of one of the plant's three reactors. Mm. And according to employees who later talked, the plant's security systems and communication systems all shut down for the time that the UFO was above it.
It's crazy.
But right before, security guards opened fire with fucking shotguns of all weapons.
Yeah.
The most useless possible long-range weapon you could find.
It didn't even kill Dick Cheney's friend.
It didn't even kill me. I got shot with a shotgun when I was like 10. And it was from so far, definitely closer than the UFO was.
Hey, buddy, I know. Yep. I play in Division 2. I accidentally switched to my sniper rifle with a shotgun. Horrible decision.
Immediately dead. But I just love the immediate power of a shotgun. It's why I also like crossbows. Like it on your hip and just fucking blam and things explode, man. It's fucking awesome.
True. But anyway, right before they were about to open fire, the UFO flew away and everything returned to normal.
Okay.
Bye-bye, nerds. Bye-bye.
And this hadn't been the first time something like this happened on U.S. soil. In 1973, a large glowing object was seen hovering above the Manzano Nuclear Weapons Inspection Facility in New Mexico.
A book to read is called Need to Know by Timothy Good that has an incredible breakdown of military UFO sightings over the last 50 years. And this is one that is, that's just a little snippet of this fucking glowing object that showed up. And it just, it hovers. It showed up and they watch it zap a beam where the weapons were. And same thing of the several ICBM tours. They talk about the original testings of several ICBMs. They would shoot up the ICBM and then a fucking sphere would catch up to speed next to it, do a perfect circle around it, and to each cardinal point on the compass, it flashes white, boom, boom, ICBM falls out of the sky.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. And then, about 2 years after the Manzano incident, a sergeant named Charles L. Moody claimed to have been abducted from Holloman Air Force Base in Alamogordo, New Mexico, where he got rotted by a bunch of thin-lipped grays.
Well, it could have been the Russians.
It could have been the Russians. But honestly, for that story, you should really read the Need to Know Timothy Good story because it's a really good abduction mini chapter.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and those incidents don't even cover, like Henry said, the dozens of low-level intrusions over intercontinental ballistic missile bases. Now, what you might be asking here, though, is why does this seem to happen mostly to Americans?
Right.
Huh.
Even Rendlesham, to bring it back to our original subject, happened to Americans near American military bases, despite the location of said bases being on British soil.
Hmm.
Now, the more cynical might say that Americans are just a gullible people, or, at the very least, more fanciful.
Okay, could be.
And granted, we can be. We can be a very, very gullible people.
Yeah, kind of.
And our imaginations can run away with us. It's why we produce some of the best entertainment in the world.
Absolutely.
That's what we're good at.
Yeah.
Yeah, we make the best entertainment in the world, and sometimes we make massive mistakes when it comes to governing the country. I mean, we just do massive, horrible things.
Yeah.
We followed our imaginations.
Yeah.
But it could also be that whatever it is that controls these UFOs is more interested in us because we were the first ones to split the fucking atom.
USA! 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 We stole it from the Germans. USA! USA!
USA!
No, we did not.
We did not!
No. No. We did not.
We got help. We got help from the Germans.
Yes, but that's... And I did think about that because it's the aliens aren't going to be paying attention to individual tiny little things. They're going to be paying attention to which government produced it.
Nice.
And that makes Americans both the most innovative and the most dangerous creatures on Earth.
Woo!
Yeah, all right. All right.
That's my whip crack. Whip crack!
Yeah. I mean, Einstein, I mean, there were definitely Germans involved in it, but mostly it was the Germans that took us to the moon. By the time the Germans got over here, World War II was already done.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking us to the moon, anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Von Braun.
Yeah, because on the moon, there is no juice.
Oh, that's
what
not
that?
Right.
What was that? The director of the NASA? Nothing. You're lucky we're good at forgetting.
Also, I'm fairly certain there's some anti-Semitic websites who believe that Jewish individuals come from the moon.
It's very interesting. How
so I don't know if
it's
that's...
It's like all nonsense is nonsense.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And it also might not be a coincidence that New Mexico seems to be lousy with UFO sightings and abductions, because New Mexico was the site of the very first atomic bomb detonation, the Trinity Blast.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
I really love Detective Comics' Marcus Parks. That's my favorite, is what he actually does. Like, because it's true. I honestly, this really does. Again,
that's interesting.
But we're really laying out the yellow bricks of the nuts and bolts UFO road, right? These are what the core beliefs are, if that's the nature of the phenomenon.
All right, cool.
So, with that in mind, let's get into the stories of the sightings at Rendlesham Forest.
And before we do it real quick, I know we have a lot of Rendlesham heads out there that are listening to the show. Just know, what we're trying to do here is we're going to lay out the facts, as we know, from Pennison's notebook and because if you don't know, then all of this is fucking garbage to you. Pennison's notebook and Holt's recordings. We're going through all of this. But know that there are many side quests in this little story that we will be covering in next episode.
All right.
Yeah.
Live from your grave.
Now, while a lot of people witnessed UFOs in the skies on those two nights, there are two dudes who actually saw this thing up close. John Burroughs and Jim Penniston, both solid career Air Force men at the time of the sighting. John Burroughs was an airman first class and eventually served in the Air Force for 27 years. Penniston was a senior security officer in charge of day-to-day base security, responsible for the warfighting resources on the base. These guys were not low-level grunts. They were not Jeep drivers. These guys were in charge of some big top-level shit. So, on the night of December 26, 1980, John Burroughs saw strange red and blue lights in Rendlesham Forest, outside the walls of the base, while patrolling the east gate of Woodbridge.
Hmm.
Now, this shit's fucking creepy, because Rendlesham Forest is thick as shit, and so they're just out there. It's cold as fuck. It's Christmas. Everybody, all the regular maintenance people are off, right? So the bases are half full, and they're just out there waiting, and they just see, like, these fucking two ghostly lights just out in the fucking forest, and they have to fucking call it in.
That's awesome. Okay.
Now, considering how the lights were on top of each other and were flashing on and off, it was thought that it was possible that an aircraft had crashed out in the forest.
Mm.
So the report was run through the proper channels. It first went to Staff Sergeant Bud Steffens.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yep.
I can't get hard, but my hands are hard.
Bud Steffens contacted Sergeant Crash McCabe.
These are Bud and Crash? Are they a tag team?
I literally cannot drive 55. Unfortunately, because I have had my license taken away from me due to the nature of my drinking problem.
Okay. Still can fly, though. That's good.
And Crash McCabe got a hold of Staff Sergeant John Coffey.
Okay.
Like the drink, but not spelled the same.
And John Coffey ran it up to the on-duty flight chief at Woodbridge, Staff Sergeant Jim Penniston.
All right.
Now, it's important for you to know that, because that's what's hard with all of these books, especially with Encounter at Rendlesham Forest, is that they really try to
dot the I's across the T's of every single bit of the military data so that you can know as a true UFO nerd that they have made sure that they documented every single bit of the communication, because this is how many people have to go through just to go check out these lights.
Right, okay.
They have to okay it with everybody.
Yeah. Sure.
And that's when Peniston figured he'd better check on this thing himself. So, Peniston headed out to the East Gate with his driver, Airman First Class Edward Cabinsag.
But he's like, that's like a, I don't know how to pronounce that name.
I think it's,
because I believe it's Thai.
Yeah, Cabinsag.
Cabinsag?
Cabinsag.
All right, it's fine.
Cabinsag.
You know. I like it.
Yeah, but when they got there, Bud Steffens made a strange remark about the light.
So they've arrived at the light.
Arrived at the East Gate.
At the East
Gate. They're arrived at the East Gate. They just watch these lights there. They have been watching it for a small period of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
See.
Yeah.
And see, I don't know why I turned into Spanish. Yes. I see. I've been watching Highly Questionable on ESPN, and they say see or no.
Oh, well.
Bud Steffens made this remark. He said, quote,
"It didn't crash. It landed."
Oh, my God. This is like a movie.
Yeah.
And at the same time, somebody over in the control tower checked the radar and placed calls to other Air Force bases in the area, in addition to Heathrow Airport in London, about 100 miles away, to find out if they saw anything. It turned out a bogey had been tracked about 15 minutes before the lights out in the forest were seen, but the target had disappeared from radar screens directly over Woodbridge.
Whoa!
Yeah, it showed up on the radar, and the first thing they saw was the cigar smoke. And then it said, verbatim,
"It's looking at you, kid."
And then it disappeared.
That's bogey.
Humphrey Bogart.
Humphrey Bogart.
No, I mean, it's another joke that no one will get. I mean, we didn't even get it.
Yeah,
I like it. I mean, I also like it.
I paused to go through what it could possibly be.
Yeah.
And then eventually realized that it's a joke that Ed Asner would have made.
Yeah, and Ed Asner.
Yes.
Yeah, he's one of the good ones.
A bogey means an unidentified radio object.
Okay, very cool. All right, got it, love it. Here's looking at you, bogey.
And so, with that in mind, Peniston, Burroughs, and another guy named Master Sergeant Chandler started to make their way into the forest to see what they could see, while the driver, Cabinsag, hung back.
Did Chandler bring his duck?
What?
I'm full of jokes. Today
that
is two jokes.
I don't even know. I don't know what that joke means.
Friends.
It's a Friends reference. Ben is full of beans today.
Oh, wow.
I'm full of beans today. I mean, I'm going to get some hate mail for this.
But as they were approaching the lights in the forest, all four of their radios started to malfunction as if something was interfering with their communications. So, in order to relay messages back to the base, Chandler returned to Cabinsag at the Jeep.
Huh.
So now, it was down to just Burroughs and Peniston.
Okay.
They walked further into the dark forest towards the light coming through the trees, but they said the air changed as they drew closer.
Ooh.
They said it felt as if the air was crackling with static electricity, and the hairs on their arms were standing on end. Then it became difficult to walk normally because their legs felt like they were wading through deep water.
Wow.
I watched a slide presentation of Jim Peniston from 2019 because he has a new book coming out called The Rendlesham Enigma. And I was watching this presentation of his, but he was talking about it, and he tried to show. He's like, "And I'll show you right now. It was difficult for me to walk. It was like walking through soup." And he tried to show. He's like, "Because it's not like now how I can lift my knees." And he lifted his leg up maybe an inch. It's like, "It was difficult for me to lift my knees. And they could see I was struggling, wading through the soup."
Interesting. But now they weren't walking through water. They weren't walking through anything. It was just normal ground.
Just walking through the forest.
Wow.
Then finally, they came to the source of light in a small clearing. When they walked towards the object, they said they were blinded by a silent, sudden explosion of light. Both men instinctively hit the ground, but when they felt no debris and heard no debris falling, they stood back up. By the reports of Jim Peniston, they were faced with a small triangular metal craft about 9 feet tall by 9 feet wide, resting on three legs, kind of like how the lunar landing module looked.
Cool.
And the way they described it is it had rounded edges, right? It had this, and he said it had a dorsal fin and it had two wings. And he looked at it, he said, one of the weirdest things about it is that it was coursing with what he called globular light. He said, it's the only way, he's trying to describe what it looked like. He said, the closest that you could call it is like a lava lamp.
Huh.
Was that the actual outsides of it had blue and red and yellow kind of floating through it like it was a glass filled with liquid.
Was it tangible? Was it actually a tangible light? Okay, we'll get into that.
Now, on the side was a bank of blue lights, and on top was a bright white light. But as we hear again and again with UFO sightings, it made no sound whatsoever.
Hmm.
But Peniston was curious. So he walked closer. When retelling the story, Peniston refers to the area immediately around the UFO as the bubble field. He said that once he entered it, all ambient noise ceased to exist, as if the air around him was dead and the static electricity got stronger. He said he tried to turn and yell for John Burroughs, who was only about 10 feet behind him, but he found that John was standing motionless and didn't react to his calls in any way whatsoever.
Straight up, Burroughs was just standing and staring at this object as the lights were bouncing off of him. Peniston turns back and he says the only way to describe it is that he felt the thing calm down, like it was the light slowed until it became a black object. And now what he said in his mind at the time was that I'm just about to die. This is a weapon. Whatever this is, he's like, this is obviously not a crash. He calls in. He has to change the parameters to helping hands. And the term helping hands over that time period, which is there's something that is about to affect the safety and the working quality of the base, something
right.
That term, where he's like, this is going to fuck us up. This is a weapon. But he wasn't sure if the radio was getting through. So he pulled out his notebook and started making notes and then approached the vehicle. Because he was like, if I'm going to die, I need to document this.
Helping hands also sounds like the off menu at a massage parlor. Like, I'll have the helping hands, please.
So once Peniston got near the object, he saw strange symbols etched on the side, which were totally unrecognizable, apart from a passing resemblance to Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Wow, cool.
He said he felt relieved when he saw the symbols, because he's like, okay, this is something.
Yeah.
For now, I think, for a second, he's like, I'm going insane.
Right.
When he saw the symbols, he's like, all right, now this has to come from somewhere then.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's also not a bomb if they put symbols on the side.
You should look at, did you see any of these symbols, Kessel?
No, I actually didn't see any of those.
It's pretty fucking cool.
Awesome.
It is. I mean, it's alien writing.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
Yeah. Then Peniston decided to actually touch the damn thing. He said the surface felt hard and smooth, like running your hand over glass, but the symbols were rough, like sandpaper. But when Peniston touched the symbols, the white light on top of the craft became so bright that Peniston was temporarily blinded. And when he took his hand back, the light dimmed once more.
Cool.
Then Peniston just kind of stood there for a while, like taking it all in, making sketches, doing sketches of fucking everything, like trying to document what was happening.
By then he realized that he wasn't going to die.
Yeah.
He was like, all right, well, I'm not going to die, so now I really have to do it. So he paced the whole thing. He's just like, he does his whole, like, tall man math, where he was like, I'm 6'3". I got a 3.5-foot stride. I did 3 strides each. That's as exact as it gets, folks. And the whole MUFON audience is like,
Yes. So he literally set up an easel, put up a little canvas, and started painting like Bob Ross.
Yeah, just trying to see, like, he had a little police notebook that he carried around with him always. And he was like, and a pencil, and he just sketched all of it down.
Interesting.
And finally, though, the craft slowly began to lift off the ground, and everything felt as if it was moving in slow motion. Then, after about 2 to 3 minutes, the craft finally rose above the trees. Then, once it had cleared the trees without making any sound whatsoever, it flew away at an impossible speed. In fact, this is the note Peniston made in his notebook. Quote,
speed? Impossible.
Impossible speed.
Wow.
I mean, that's Speed 4. That's a great name for the movie. Yeah, that's awesome.
Impossible speed?
Speed impossible.
Impossible.
Ooh, I like that. Very cool.
But here's the strange thing. Remember, John Burroughs was standing only 10 feet behind Jim Peniston.
But he remembers the incident completely differently, although he still maintains that he saw something. Burroughs claimed that after the initial blinding flash of light came, he hit the ground and saw a red, oval, sun-like object in the clearing. He saw no craft whatsoever.
Huh.
And instead of the close encounters experience had by Peniston, Burroughs said his experience lasted only a few seconds.
Strange.
Or at least, that's what he claimed later.
Oh.
Yeah.
When he gave his original statement about the incident 72 hours afterward, he included a sketch of the craft that looked a hell of a lot like Peniston's.
So he was sketching also?
From his recollection.
Okay.
From his memory, yes.
Oh, I see.
From his memory.
Okay.
Now, although he may have just been going along to get along.
Which is difficult, because Peniston, which we'll talk about, Peniston took full weight of talking to the superiors.
Okay.
So he said, when they were all freaking out afterwards, they were all like, what are we going to say to our bosses? And he's like, you're not going to say anything. I'm going to say something.
Okay.
So he went forward and took all the blame. So I don't know if going along to get along even works for that, because he already was to blame. Like, they were already on Peniston. They didn't
the
need to back
here?
Him up.
But what's he being blamed for? Just seeing something?
Calling him crazy.
Right,
yeah, calling
right,
him crazy.
Sure.
But this story, it's very, very interesting. We'll talk about this. This is where it gets woo-wee-woo.
Okay.
Which the idea of being like, what happens if our brain is an operating system and an entity is like a program that shows up in front of you? What if it's like a thing and that you interpret it the way you interpret it? And everybody's seeing shit and feeling shit.
Yeah, couldn't you? I mean, I could see my brain just totally shutting down.
Yeah.
Like, yes. When you see something that, like, what oftentimes they say when you have extreme trauma, like when your bone pops through the skin, like what happened with Paul George, your brain literally shuts off and you're like, you can't remember this because this really is too much for you to handle.
Shock.
Shock, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolute shock. And, you know, to take it even further with what Henry said about the operating system, you know, if our brain is an operating system and these things are programmed, you know, you can't run, say, a Mac program on a PC. Can't run a PC program on a Mac. So some brains are able to run these programs, others are not.
Interesting.
And this is obviously a last podcast theory and other people's theories as well that believe this about the psychic nature of UFOs. So take that as you will.
Oh yeah, I mean, I know there are going to be people that are going to roll their eyes and say whatever about the operating system conversation.
No, it makes sense.
You know, there are plenty of people out there that are just fine with believing the humans are just a bunch of walking shit bags walking around going.
Oh, come on!
Plenty of people. Plenty of people that are just fine.
They won't do that.
And plenty of people saying, "Oh, let's just talk about killing." And people and all that, but you know what? Some of us like to be curious about the mysteries of the universe.
Very
yes.
good.
Some of us think that there might be a little bit more out there.
I don't know why. I don't know why you guys have made yourself defensive. Because there is no one listening nor out there that is just like, we better go give these guys a wedgie immediately.
It is a disease that ufologists get. You just become, you just slowly, no matter, it's like you talk in a conversational tone, and all of a sudden it says, you think you know me? You think you know, you better do the reading. You come at me, you do the reading.
I think what it comes from is, you know, because I like to look at both sides, and I type in the incident, and then I type in skeptic, and the people who write skeptical responses to UFO incidents are the snottiest people on Earth. And because they always, they're very fond of the phrase, so much for that.
No, Henry said the snottiest people on Earth were the British.
No, but that's physically snotty, not emotionally snotty.
Well, either way, depending on, you know, no matter what Peniston saw or what Burroughs saw, both men said that they saw a light above them after the flash.
Awesome.
Flying around, and it eventually flew away over the coast out east. Then they looked down at the ground and found that there were three indentations where the craft had been. Now remember, this was December, so the ground was frozen solid, but the indentations were deep enough where it was obvious something very heavy had been resting there.
Huh.
And those three indentations formed a near-perfect equilateral triangle.
Cool.
Furthermore, branches had been snapped off from the trees on the edges of the clearing where the craft had landed and taken off, including branches from way up high.
Yeah, man, there's tree rubbins. Yeah. That's the term I kept seeing was tree rubbins. Yeah.
Tree rubbins.
Tree rubbins.
Okay.
In other words, if they're telling the truth, some real weird shit had just happened.
Yeah.
But what was really weird was what they discovered when they returned to Cabin Sag and Chandler. By the reckoning of Burroughs, Peniston, and their watches, they'd only been out of radio contact for 5, maybe 10 minutes.
Hmm.
But in reality, they'd been gone 45 minutes.
Whoa! Yep.
And what was more, both of their watches were running 45 minutes slow.
Yep.
That is crazy. So we have lost time.
We have lost time. Yep. And not just lost time, but time that is manipulated mechanics.
What? So we have the actual touching of a spacecraft, scene of a spacecraft, drawings of a spacecraft, lost time. I mean, yes. this is pretty much everything you need.
This is what we love.
Yeah.
This is why we're covering this case.
Cool.
It's because this was the weirdest shit, because they came back just being like, why are you like acting like they were literally just sitting in the truck like they had been gone for 45 minutes. They're like, we just left. And they're like, no, you were gone for almost an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, and they'd also been calling back to the base, and because the base was checking up on them and saying like,
where the hell are these guys? And they say they're in current investigation. They're trying to push off the bosses, because the bosses would be like, what the fuck's happening? Because mm-hmm. they'd have to scramble more people if there's a real emergency.
Right.
Or if they died.
Right, right.
And furthermore, when these guys were debriefed, they found they weren't the only ones who saw weird shit that night. Now, some say that what the witnesses outside of Peniston and Burroughs saw that night was actually the breakup of a Russian satellite or a meteor shower, and both are on record for having occurred that night in the south of England.
Well, how would it go back up into the sky, though?
Well, that's the thing.
Well,
it's possible.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, huh?
It's the thing is that it's possible that that is what some of the people saw. Some of the people who reported seeing things in the sky that night probably saw a meteor shower, or they saw the breakup of the Russian satellite. But that doesn't explain what Peniston and Burroughs experienced.
Right.
Nor does it explain the lights inside the forest that they went to go investigate in the first place.
Mm.
Nor does it explain the bogey on the radar.
And where was Lauren Bacall?
Well, that's a question we could ask every second of every day.
But no, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Because a part of it comes from the misdating that Peniston did on his notebook. That he said that was a true mistake, and others say was purposeful. He was lying, saying that he was essentially lying about the entire thing.
Huh.
Which is weird. But I feel like maybe it might have been a mistake. I don't know. But that's because on the night in question, the 26th, was the night all this happening, was when these two other aerial phenomena were also happening. And the 27th, it was not.
When it comes to him lying, I guess everyone will be like, did he make a lot of money? Did he get famous? Was his career, and I'm sure we'll cover this, but was his career helped by this? Did he make money with this? Or
no,
is it like,
man,
more traditional?
No. Peniston, it's highly embarrassing.
Okay, so that kind of debunks the idea that maybe he wanted to benefit from it financially.
No.
Okay.
No.
And furthermore, there was another actual incident that night that wasn't just lights in the sky. Two more personnel reported lights in the forest. And when they went out to investigate, a white light had engulfed their Jeep, and the Jeep completely stalled out, and they couldn't get it to start again.
Wow.
Now, what's interesting about this incident is that for jurisdictional and legal reasons, the Americans were required to notify British authorities that they were going off base to investigate a possible crash.
Interesting.
Now, while you'd think they'd be calling the British military or some such, who they actually called in this situation when they left the base was the local cops.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they're going to take the billy clubs to it.
Yeah.
All right. The local
like
constable. Yeah, exactly.
And here's what the local police wrote in their logs as to what happened that night. Quote,
"We have had a call from the LA at Bentwaters in reference to the UFO reported last night. We have found a place where a craft of some sort seems to have landed."
Oh, I do feel like he's got a little, like a napkin stuffed into the top of his shirt. They're fun. They're lobster. It sounds like they're always eating lobster.
Yeah, or the bangers and mash.
Ooh, yeah. Mm, I'm actually excited for the UK food. I think I'm going to do beans this time.
Do the full English.
I'm actually going to do it.
Full English is great.
Yeah. I don't understand
it. It's a good way to start
it,
your day just full of shit.
I know. It's like beans and bread for breakfast. Triple B's.
And a tomato.
And a tomato. Great.
So by the next morning, the whole thing had become a bit of a joke on the base.
Already?
Yeah, already, of course.
Oh, yeah, dude, all night. Because they were like, where were they? They were out for an hour chasing UFOs. So everybody's fucking flipping out and having a great time about the shenanigans that happened the night before.
Okay.
Yeah. And you got to remember, I mean, this is 1980 Air Force Base in England. Like, it is Cold War paranoia, so everyone is both on high alert and extraordinarily bored at the same time.
Right, yeah. Right.
And the joke vibe was what Colonel Charles Holt walked into at 5 a.m. when he reported for duty. Now, Sergeant Crash McCabe told Holt that Peniston and Burroughs had been out chasing UFOs all night.
Hmm.
And Holt was actually all about playing the whole thing down. He suggested they use the term unexplained lights in the official report instead of saying UFOs, because he didn't want shit to get out of hand.
Right.
Charles Holt is a very serious human being at this point in time. He has never smiled in a single picture.
Right.
I've been reading the Holt perspective written by Charles Holt.
It's called perspective.
Yes.
Sounds like you lost a job on Fox News to Bill O'Reilly.
I'm pitching
a show, the Holt perspective. What is your perspective? I hate my grandson.
There's too many Starbucks and the coffee is too brown.
And that's the Holt perspective.
Charles Holt wrote a 500-page entire breakdown of UFOs around the Rendlesham Force. Like, he went completely nuts. But when you read this, what happens to him afterwards, we'll get into more in the second episode.
Right.
But Charles Holt believes he truly is the main player of this entire story.
But he is also a believer that there was a UFO here.
Oh, yeah.
He became one.
Interesting. Yes. Okay, very interesting.
Yeah, he became one. And even though, like, kind of the rank and file of the base, they were all treating this as a joke, the higher-ups were taking it much more seriously.
Really?
Almost immediately, documents concerning the incident, specifically security blotters and incident and complaint reports, were pulled and classified as secret by base commander Ted Conrad.
All right.
What was weird about this was that it completely bypassed Colonel Holt. Colonel Holt should have been involved in these sorts of actions. And as far as he was concerned, the documents had pretty much been stolen from under his nose.
Huh.
I can literally just see Charles Holt, who's probably about 2 inches shorter than me, just like jumping for files that two like other officers are just throwing above him to each other and leaving. Aww. And he'd be like, that's not fair. I'm the one that went down there. I went down there and I saw the alpha myself. That's how he sounds. It's very strange accent.
Maybe he's Massachusetts. Perhaps he's a Bostonian.
Yeah, it sounds like
yes.
It. And there was some attempt at investigation, but the problem was that the Air Force had no standard operating procedure for the investigation of a UFO incursion on or near a military base.
That's interesting. 1980. I would have thought they would have had some protocol for unidentified flying objects.
We scrapped it in 1969. We stopped officially investigating. Stop. Whoosh, swish, swish. Quotation marks. Swish, 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 swish. We stopped officially investigating UFOs then, when we stopped Project Blue Book. So all of the standard operating procedures, all that shit has been thrown out.
Okay.
Because there's not supposed to be standard operating
Interesting.
Procedures.
Mm-hmm. Now, one dude, Major Edward Drury, thought that the whole thing had been a Christmas prank.
Oh, man, I love Christmas pranks.
There was one
time my cousin Robert did this really funny Christmas prank where he was deployed overseas, right? And he wanted to surprise his family. So he came in and he showed up, like he dressed himself in a big box for Christmas, like a big bow on top of it. And the family was like, you know, my cousin's so excited to see him. They didn't know, you know what I mean? Like he was coming home for Christmas. And then when he popped out of the box, the problem is that he had some kind of like flashback or something. And he killed his whole family.
Really?
And that was like the craziest Christmas prank.
That is, yeah. I wasn't aware that pranks on Christmas was a thing, but
I was not aware Christmas pranks were a thing either.
Okay.
Yeah, man. No, that's you over Christmas. All we do is we dress up as Santa, I break into people's homes, I tell them I'm leaving presents, and then I just shit. I just shit all over the living room.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because your kids were bad.
I guess so.
But after debriefing Peniston and Burroughs and hearing that something had come up on radar that night, Drury figured there might be something to this incident. So, a bunch of guys went out to the site, took photographs and such, but they kind of figured that was going to be the end of it. But the next night, on December 27th, the UFOs returned.
Ooh.
This is fucking so sweet. This is the best part. Is it? Like, because also, it's a Christmas story.
Yeah,
this whole thing is around Christmas. So it's all this shit. Like, they're literally doing the jingle bells, jingle bell, rock. Like, they have, like, fucking Santa hats on. They're all getting fucking hammered on eggnog. And this shit's going down.
Live from your grave. Live from your grave.
Now, the night of the second sighting was set to be a relaxing evening of R&R, because that was the night of the Combat Support Group awards dinner at an on-base bar called Woody's that was located, naturally, on the Woodbridge base.
I love it. Oh, my God. That would be so much fun.
So much fun.
It's kind of cool. But they set it up like a little town. It's kind of like Auschwitz, where they set up this little town where they lived in. But I mean, that's the only thing I can compare it to.
I know it's
right
the only thing that you can compare
brain.
It to. I don't know if it's the best comparison.
I can compare it to, I don't know, the fucking military base that my uncle and his family lived on when I was
that's
a kid. It's all military bases are like this. They have a bar. They have a PX. They have all kinds of shit. They are a little town.
Okay, I don't know.
You were correct.
I'm not allowed in the military. I have blood clots.
But just as they were getting into the swing of things that night, Lieutenant Bruce England, who was on duty and sober, came inside looking shaken. He took Colonel Halt aside and told him that the UFO had returned.
Oh.
And so Halt, who was also sober.
Well, you're really stressing the sober thing. Are they?
You
are you
to.
Sure they're
you
not
have
hammered?
To. You have to, because okay. That's like, well, you know, they had a Christmas party that night, so much for that theory.
But
no, it's like,
yeah,
they
okay.
were, not all of them were blasted.
Okay, great.
Some of them were. Not all of them were.
I actually would trust the drunk person more than the sober person in this. Because
absolutely
the drunk
not.
Person's going to run right up to the plane, tackle it, wrestle
no.
around with it, and bring
no.
it back to the barracks.
It doesn't need to be like they're tailgating at a Packers game
okay,
in order for
know.
You to get substantial evidence about UFOs. You got to be clear-headed.
Okay.
You have to be annoyingly clear-headed.
All right, yeah. all right.
So Halt decided to check it out. First, he assembled a team of sober men and called up Sergeant Monroe Nevels and Master Sergeant Bobby Balls. No, wait, never mind. His name is actually Bobby Ball. Bobby Balls is a typo on my part.
Oh, I'm sorry, goddammit.
It would really be nice if I did have two testicles, but unfortunately, I'll be Bobby Ball.
I'll be Bobby Ball. And I try to refer it normally as a basketball, because people hate hearing a man not having two balls. They respect me less.
Yeah,
but he actually got the entire group from Revenge of the Nerds together
right.
to go out and look at these UFOs, because it was the only sober people at the Christmas party.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
Bobby and Monroe.
I love it. All right.
Now, one of the first things Halt wanted done was to set up a bunch of light-alls. And light-alls, they're essentially floodlights on wheels that you can use to watch the skies.
Okay.
But the light-alls weren't working. Now, some say that they were just out of gas, and some of them certainly were, but not all of them. Some of them just weren't working, just like the radios hadn't worked a couple nights before. Of course, the base was getting fired up, partly because they were getting a little action in the middle of a boring Cold War standoff, and partly because, admittedly, a lot of them were half in the bag from the Christmas party.
Of course!
And you know for a fact that him and the nerd squad are trying to set up these light-alls, and they're just throwing bottles of beer at him, and like they're shaking whiskey at him, being like, yeah, fucking get your UFOs, nerd,
you know,
go get them! While they're like, they're all just really being like, this is about the integrity of the base! Like, they're trying to keep the calm while everyone's screaming at him.
One dude is just like, hey, Tommy, look at this, takes off all of his clothes, tucks his penis between his legs, and just goes and prances out in front of the sober group of alien hunters, be like, I guess I'm an alien, aren't I?
I'm an alien.
alien. Yeah.
Do you boys want to probe me? Reverse alien.
Charles Holt be like, this is very serious. This is a serious time, and this is military expenditures.
Well, Holt was not one of those men. He was not one of the drunk ones. In fact, Holt was meticulous. So he took a handheld tape recorder everywhere he went to record his thoughts and observations, kind of like, as Nick Pope points out, Dale Cooper.
Oh, yes, of course.
So after Holt gave the order to refill the light alls or to do whatever the fuck needed to be done to get them working, he and his team headed out to the original landing site. Although we don't really know why they went to the original landing site.
They didn't see the lights over there. They just kind of instinctively went over there.
Well, we don't know. We don't know why they went out there. The answer, though, might be on one of Holt's tapes. 18 minutes of Holt's recordings from that night are available to the public. But according to an interview Holt did in 1999, he actually made 4 to 5 hours of tapes on December 27th, 1980.
Yes, which shows that obviously what we're getting is a highly curated version of these events.
Yeah, highly curated is a hell of a nice way of putting redacted, of saying redacted.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But when asked to elaborate on what those tapes contained, Holt refused to comply, saying that most likely the public would never hear what was recorded.
Hey, get out of the way, guy with his penis between his legs. You're not an alien.
I'm an alien.
No, you're not an alien.
Come and get me. I'm an alien.
Yeah, buddy, you're not going to feel so happy when you wake up at 5 a.m. hungover and I'm making you do 100 push-ups, okay?
I'm an alien and I hear some dumb police officer.
So, in other words, we just got to make do with what we have here.
Wow.
Now, the first part of the tape, as they arrive to the landing site, is pretty standard. Just them using a Geiger counter to inspect the area. But then, they found something intriguingly radioactive directly below the craft's landing site.
Hmm. We found a small blast, what looks like a blasted or scrubbed up area here. Yeah, very positive readings. Let's see, is that near the center?
Yes, it is. This is what we would assume would be the dead center.
Just thinking about more as you go along the whole area now. Up to 7/10 or 7 units, it's called, on the 0.5 scale.
Wow, that's... So they're acting as if... I mean, they seem to be acting authentically surprised.
Very much
so. Or just intrigued at the very least.
Now, what Nick Pope claims is that this reading, 7/10, is 10 times what the normal radiation should be and is therefore proof that a UFO landed on this exact site. But on this point, we have to go with the skeptics.
Well, this is... It's interesting because people love the concept of UFOs and radiation, that radiation is the smoking gun. Mm-hmm. And then you got to get radiation. There's something about it. It's like the way they take hypnotic regression very, very seriously, where they believe this is the evidence you got to have. But we don't really know how the hell these things work. I don't know. Like they say, they're just looking for anything that seems to prove scientifically radiation is the way to show that UFO showed up.
Is there any chance that because it's a nuke site or potentially a nuke site that the radiation would be higher?
Well,
I don't know.
For one, it's obvious from the recording that this was a spike and not a steady reading, which that spike could have been anything from environmental radiation to a malfunction of the needle.
Okay.
If it was an actual radioactive site, it would have gone...
Ooh, that sounds like a fun bubble lawnmower.
Yeah.
Start it up.
But it didn't. It was just one single spot.
But it could have gone.
It could have gone.
I don't know. It's surprisingly peaceful. It is a shockingly peaceful sound. I think I want you to record that on loop for 30 minutes, and I'll just go to sleep listening to.
Yeah, it's ASMR, but it means you're slowly getting radiation poisoning.
Oh, I see. All right.
Well, furthermore, they were using the wrong type of Geiger counter to test for background radiation, meaning the readings they were taking were utterly useless.
These are the sober ones?
Yeah, these are the sober ones.
Come on.
They didn't know. However, just because the radiation is a bust does not mean that this entire incident is debunked.
Okay.
In fact, the debunkers may have ended up supporting one of
our positions with their due diligence.
Okay.
Yes, you played into our hands, didn't you?
Yes, I'm Henry Debunker. This is my wife, Harriet Debunker. We're the Debunker family. It's because we're mostly butt.
See, the Debunkers figured out what kind of Geiger counter the men in the field were using. And it turns out that Geiger counter was more suited to monitoring major nuclear accidents, such as the kind that might happen at a place that stores nuclear weapons.
Whoa!
We got you, you fucking bitch! We got you! Yes!
Wow! Yes. Cool!
Now, it could be this Geiger counter was standard issue to every Air Force facility during the Cold War. You don't know.
Sure.
Maybe, but you don't find basketballs on a football field, okay, friend?
A Kissel, you might.
Well, you
someone might have brought a basketball to a football field. It's still sports.
No, right,
still
I don't sports. Know. That, that,
you might not find a pool net at a football field.
I don't think you would find it. That's a whole nother story.
But, yeah, even if. You know, these are at every single place. It's nonetheless interesting that this facility in particular had this particular piece of equipment.
Cool.
Sure.
But back to the landing site. This next clip is Lieutenant England describing what he was seeing concerning marks on the trees as he and the other men inspected the area in question.
Yeah. Each one of these trees that face into the blast, what we assume is a landing site, all have an abrasion. Facing in the same direction towards the center, the same direction. Well, let's go this way around the circle here. Turn it back down here. Pick up the collection. Let me see that. Well, that's kind of funny. That's you're right about the abrasion. I've never seen a tree that's never seen a pine tree that's been damaged react that fast.
I got a bottle to put that in.
Yeah, okay. You got a sample bottle?
We'll just put this for the soil. Put the
yeah, here, sit this on the ground.
You'll notice they're all the same.
Okay, from now on, let's identify that as point number one. Let's stake there. So you all know where it is. We have to sketch it. You got that, Sergeant Nevels?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Closest to the
Woodbridge
base.
So they're taking soil samples here, right? Of the
yes.
Of the indentations, of the three triangular indentations.
Yes, where the UFO supposedly landed, and they're noticing the tree rubbings.
So we have them. This is great.
Yeah.
So they are like legitimately in real time expressing exactly what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, and as you can hear, although they stay professional, these men are steadily growing more and more concerned.
Right, right.
Then, using night vision, the men started finding hot spots, like spots that were literally still warm.
What? On the ground.
On the ground and mm-hmm. on the trees.
Wow.
Yes. You saw there's a positive after effect?
Yes, there is definitely.
That's on the center spot. There is an after effect.
What does that mean?
When the lights are turned off, once we are focused in and allow time for the eyes to adjust, we are getting an indication of a heat source coming out of that center spot, as which will show up on the
heat or some form of energy. It's hardly heat at this stage of the game.
It's 32 degrees outside. That's a part of it that, like, this. It's winter time. So
right.
It is very strange for this heavily packed soil to have heat radiating out from the somewhere in the bottom of it.
Right. I mean, it does beg the question, do the aliens know it's Christmas?
I
don't know. No, that is.
Does it matter if they don't celebrate?
Exactly.
Then it's just like, I mean, that's my thing.
That is really awesome, compelling audio, though.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. All right.
Dude, and there's still so much more to go. Then, very suddenly, they started hearing noises from some of the nearby farms, or at least from the surrounding wildlife.
Well, 148, we're hearing very strange sounds out of the farmers barnyard animals. They're very, very active, making an awful lot of noise.
The animals are freaking out. Like, there's now something happening. We're now whatever the event is starting to freak out all animals, which is a common occurrence during a UFO, any sort of incident.
Right, right. Awesome. I mean, how important is animal reaction? And I'm not because obviously when a storm's coming, the birds know. Like, but how important is that when you have animals be like, yo, some shit is going on here, and we're not, I mean, no one is ever going to be convinced that some bizarre wolf is a conspiracy theorist on aliens.
I,
during Skinwalker Ranch, we saw that they use dogs as their bio readers. They use right. them as a the because they do experience certain levels of, I don't know if it's either they can hear more things than we know. They're more attuned to their natural instincts. They could see a little bit more of the electromagnetism of the world. I'm not really sure how that works, but they do freak out when weird shit happens.
All right, for all of our Pomeranian listeners out there, shoot us a DM. Let us know what you think.
But also, yeah, and Wendy just freaks out. Did anybody walk past the window?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they saw the light.
Uh-oh.
Pigmentation. You just saw a light
where?
There.
Wait, 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 wait.
Where?
Right on this position here. Straight ahead in between the tree. There it is again. Watch. Straight ahead off my flashlight right there, yeah, sir. There it is.
Hey, I see it too.
What is it?
We don't know, sir.
So, yeah, can I get some of
it? Yeah, it's a strange, small red light. Looks to be out maybe a quarter to half mile, maybe further out. I'm going to switch off. The light is gone now. It was approximately 120 degrees from the site. Is it back again?
Yes, sir.
Oh, that's the flashlight, sir. This one about to the edge of the clearing so I can get a better look at it. See if you can get the star scope on it. The light's still there, and all the barnyard animals have gotten quiet now. Yeah, we're heading about 110 to 120 degrees from the site out through to the clearing now. Still getting a reading on the meter. About 2 clicks. Three to four clicks, getting stronger.
Now, that part of the tape we just played is a big point of contention when it comes to the debunkers. They say that the light Halt and the other men saw at this point in the tape was just a lighthouse off the coast. And when they're talking about that light in particular, the debunkers might be right. The lighthouse in question shines at 5-second intervals. And the spot in the tape where they say, it's gone. Oh, wait, it's back again. That's exactly 5 seconds in length.
Okay.
But that doesn't explain what happened next.
Okay.
Listen to this.
Weird. It appears that he may be moving a little bit this way. It's brighter than it has been.
Yeah.
It's coming this way. Also, it is definitely coming this way.
The two
pieces of it are shooting off. There is no doubt about it. This is weird.
To the left.
Yeah, definitely moving left.
Two lights. One light to the front, okay. One light to the left.
Keep flashlights off. There's something very, very strange. Get the headset on. See if it gets any stronger.
Okay.
Give us your window.
Notation that this is on a beta reading, too.
It's on a beta reading?
Beta
okay.
Still has been removed.
Okay. This is falling off it again.
But it just moved to the right.
Yeah.
Off to the right.
Strange. Oh, yeah, why don't you left?
I do like that they reacted the exact same way all of us would, just be like,
oh, yeah.
It's weird.
What the fuck? What they Charles is seeing is that this red light that appeared to be back behind the trees,
uh-huh.
They're seeing this thing is now weaving its way through the trees.
Wow.
So, and the way that we described it, it looked like an eye, a giant red eye with a black center and a big red ring around it. And what's weird is the fact that it's coasting around and it's shooting off sparks.
Jeez.
It's shooting off these little driblets off to the side, which if you saw the live show for last podcast and left last year, I showed some footage of a UFO, like a globular-style UFO.
Right, right.
Shitting out the things out of the back of it, and it was doing the same exact thing.
Interesting. And you can get our live show from last year. You can still get it on lastpodcastlive.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's still only $6.66, so we can't wait to see everybody on the road for this year's live show, but if you want a little taste, watch last year's.
Good plug.
So this is some of the most compelling audio I've ever heard.
Yeah.
For sure.
And the other thing about the lighthouse, it's not like the lighthouse just happened to be turned on for Christmas. This thing was going constantly.
So they would have known if it was the lighthouse.
All night,
I feel,
every night.
That is my opinion.
Yes.
Is that they would have known the difference between the lighthouse and other lights
right.
on like around. And the fact that they're saying weird and the fact that it was red, and I think that's the three-dimensional quality is what
uh-huh.
kicks in here.
Yeah.
Is that they see this shit begin to approach
mm-hmm. right.
and do a little dance for them.
Yeah, and these were Air Force men. It's not like they never looked at this fucking sky.
Right.
I mean, the lighthouse was a known quantity.
Yeah.
And it could have been like just once or twice they saw the lighthouse, but you know, this is something that was a static object in their environment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think a lighthouse resembles a strange detached hemorrhoid coming towards you.
Unless it's a cool as fuck lighthouse.
Maybe, I
don't
know.
It'd be cool to have like a goth lighthouse where it's all black and it shines a red light, but I feel like, which is what a goth lighthouse would want, which is just destroy as many ships as possible.
Yeah, that wouldn't really work.
And the lighthouse theory definitely doesn't explain what happened at the end of the tape. Listen to this.
One's moving away from us. It's moving out fast.
This one on the right heading away too.
Yeah, we're both heading north. Okay, here he comes from the south. He's coming toward us now. Now we're observing what appears to be a beam coming down to the ground. This is unreal. 3:30, and the objects are still in the sky, although the one to the south looks like it's losing a little bit of altitude. We're turning around and heading back toward the base. The object to the south is still beaming down lights to the ground. 400 hours, one object still hovering over Woodbridge Base at about 5 to 10 degrees off the horizon, still moving erratic and similar lights and beaming down this area.
Wow.
Down to the ground, man. I think he's Pittsburgh. I think that's
he
what that is.
Be.
I think that's Pittsburgh.
Could
I think
be like, a
that's
Yenzer,
the insert. That's
yeah.
some kind of Pennsylvania. But yeah, man, that's fucking freaky. That's
very cool.
That's the shit. Yeah, yeah, they saw some shit.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Think about how collected you have to be as a military person to be able to see this thing like shoot a little light and not be like, ah!
Right, right. It's almost like they're not MUFON investigators and they were actually trained by competent militant minds.
I am trained by the best teacher possible, which is me.
Well, later, Halt said the light in question was pencil thin, like a laser, and it struck a point on the ground just 10 feet in front of him. Then the UFO flew right above Woodbridge and shone a light directly down to the base, which is a show of strength if I ever fucking heard one.
Yeah.
You're like, look what I can do.
Whoa.
Look what I can do, and you can't do anything. That I love that about UFOs when it's because they talk about the idea is that the presence of these things, that they acknowledge your presence. They are communicating with you.
Right.
So it's just showing you being like, what can you do? You can even shoot shotguns at me. The last guy tried that.
Right.
And he did nothing. They just all hurt each other.
And still, that wasn't the only thing that happened that night. While these guys were off in the woods, John Burroughs, from a couple of nights before, was having a second encounter.
Jeez.
When he heard the UFO was back, he'd hightailed it back to the base, because Burroughs claimed that he was inexplicably drawn to the craft. And at first, Halt had told his men to keep Burroughs the fuck away from the landing site.
Hmm.
But eventually, he and a man named Sergeant Adrian Bustinza were given...
Played by Jason Alexander in the movie.
Like that. He's very talented, very talented.
He was given permission to approach one of the lights to see if he could confirm or deny that this was indeed the same craft. But as they were driving towards the light in a Jeep, a streak of blue transparent light came streaking towards them, followed by a white object that floated in the distance.
Huh.
Then, when they got out of the Jeep to walk towards it, the light started coming towards them.
Uh-oh.
Bustinza hit the ground, but Burroughs...
It's unbelievable! It's unbelievable!
But Burroughs kept walking forward. Eventually, he disappeared into the light and was gone for several minutes before reappearing.
Whoa!
Again, he had no recollection of what happened and had missing time when he walked out. But this did add another fairly close-up witness to the phenomenon, bringing the number of people who saw something that night to about 60.
60?
60.
Yeah, dude.
Whoa.
Of military dudes. 60 military guys
yeah.
saw this shit.
But the sightings are only half the story.
Mm-hmm.
The other half is the inevitable cover-up, which we'll cover on the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, part two.
Awesome.
It's
That's
not
some...
only the cover-up, we're also going to cover... the ways specific members of this entire incident and people that were affected by it, how they went completely fucking insane.
Right.
We will talk about like the there's a lot more here. We're going to talk a little bit about binary code. We're going to talk about some people got scooped. We're going to talk about a crazy person named Larry Warren that just some kind of insinuates himself into the story somewhere in the mid-90s where he just all of a sudden, I was there too. There's a lot of those guys that will show up in this story. But awesome. Man, I
was the one who tucked my penis between the legs. I was the one who did that.
That was me. I was the idiot.
I was doing that. Wow, awesome. This is without a doubt the best UFO encounter we've ever covered.
I think, anyway. It is compelling.
Yeah, it's awesome. The audio is just so kick-ass because it's chilling. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Well, it shows that these guys really did the aftermath, too. It shows that whatever happened, they saw some shit. I don't know what the hell was going on. And then we'll also go through all the various ways whether or not this is a hoax next episode, too. Because there were several people that said that this was some kind of prank. There were people that said
Christmas
this was the Russians.
Prank. Yeah, one of those classic Christmas pranks we all know about.
Yeah, Robert. My cousin Robert. He killed his whole family.
Yeah.
That's what happens when a prank goes bad.
Awesome. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for listening. Let's see. We had a great time hanging out with all of you in Kansas City and Denver and Salt Lake City.
Oh, yeah.
No lie. That was one of the best three-day little mini tours we've ever done.
Without a doubt.
Everyone was so freaking sweet.
Yes.
Thanks for the vapes in Denver. And honestly, thanks for all the incredible artwork. We had some incredible. We don't even like. You don't need to give us any gifts. We have to fly them back and everything. But every time we receive something, y'all are just so talented. I mean, it's really awesome. We got to see Jeffrey Dahmer's high school yearbook.
That was cool as shit.
The 1977 yearbook.
I have a picture that I have to post. If you're the listener that showed us a video, please hit me up so I can tag you properly. But man, oh man, we had some good. Honestly, I just love being on the road. I love listening. Yep. I love meeting the listeners. I love doing the live show. It's so much fun.
You guys have
really made this mean a lot to us.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we'll be in Vancouver, Seattle, and Portland real soon. Vancouver still has some tickets available. So please, I don't know the next time we're getting back to Canada.
Yeah.
This might be our only Canadian trip this year, don't you think?
Yes.
I think this is our only Canadian trip. So far. You know, have fun with it. Make a weekend out of it. Drive from Calgary. Drive from Canada. Wherever you are, come and see us. It will be a very fun time. So please get those tickets to Vancouver, Seattle, and Portland. We'll see you in your beautiful cities as well very soon. And keep on supporting all the shows here on Last Podcast Network, Page 7, Top Hat, Whiz Brew, Movie Signs with the Mads. You know the shows you love. Keep on supporting the network because all ships rise and we are really trying our best to get this network, you know, off the ground. And well, it's already off the ground, but we want it to be flying even higher.
Yeah.
So we want to show you guys our tree rubbins.
Yes, we want to get the tree rubbins for you. So thank you all so much for supporting the network, and thank you all so much for giving to our Patreon. Again, without you, nothing is possible. And you know, you're part of the fam. We're like the Green Bay Packers. Everyone's part of the family here. So thank you so much. Henry and I actually had a chance to interview really awesome guest. She is the director of Hail Satan. A wonderful guest that we got to speak with.
Penny Lane. There was an really good, very, we talked about Satanism. She fucking really knows what the hell she's talking about.
She's great. And check out her documentary Hail Satan. It was wonderful. So thanks all for giving to our Patreon. And do we have any, is there any what do we have? Do we have to talk to our audience about anything right now?
We're going to be coming to Australia here in June. So, a lot of those shows are selling out. But come on out to Sydney.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perth, the whole thing.
Yeah, Sydney.
Come on out. Yeah, buy them tickets to Sydney. You buy them tickets. We're going to see you in Sydney. Can't wait to be in Australia. I can't wait to be upside down. I want to meet all the spiders. I want to give them a little kiss.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. We absolutely love you. I guess this is the time where we close it out, huh?
Yeah, it is.
All right, everyone. Hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Hail Gein.
Magustalations.
Hail me and look to the skies. You don't know what you shall see.
Well, in this case, look to the ground as well, right?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
It's good to look into the ground so you know where your feet are, I guess. I guess that does make sense.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.